Last night, we began by talking about the possibility of a spirituality that was not defined by a separate spirit as opposed to the body. And we noted how many traditional forms of spirituality or practice implicitly or explicitly separated out mind or soul or awareness from the body, either in the hope of there being a literal separation and survival of something like the soul after the death of the body, or conceiving of spiritual practice as the cultivation or purification of some aspect of the mind or spirit, freeing it from the contamination of the body in the form of thought or feeling, emotion. And I think that basic difference is encapsulated in the difference of our meditation instruction. We are not endeavoring to calm or empty the mind. We're not trying to cultivate anything like pure awareness, awareness that's free of thought, so that it's simply clear consciousness. Instead, our basic meditation instruction is feel your body breathe. There's no purification process going on here. And one of the corollaries of this is our assumption that the mind is not contaminated by its contents. We're not here to purify it. We're here to be present to it. And the difficulty that that presence presents to us is the reality of impermanence, the reality of interdependence. As we sit, we see that our mind is not something under our control, our body is not something under our control, and our life is not something under our control. But to a large degree, we must be aware and accept the reality of change and vulnerability, and that this practice is not going to allow us to master those things, much less make them go away. Now, Buddhism begins with the idea of liberation from suffering. And it comes down to us that the cause of suffering is in desire or clinging or craving or attachment. These are all various versions of how that is translated. And in contemporary Buddhism, there's a tendency to psychologize those words and think of them as psychological states of grasping, clinging. But I think it's pretty clear that in the original teachings and the original community, there was a very literal understanding of those notions in which the way to be free of suffering was to be literally free of attachment in the sense of attachment to family or loved ones, that the fundamental definition of a monk was a home leaver. That you literally severed attachments, relational attachments, and you lived a life in which you had no fixed home or abode. You lived the life of a wandering mendicant. You also had no possessions beyond your robe and your bowl. You depended on the alms of others for your survival. And the very form of life was intended to embody the reality of impermanence and interconnectedness. You literally had nothing or no one to rely on, and your life was dependent on alms received from others. So the life itself was meant to manifest or embody this teaching of impermanence and interdependence. And that life itself, because it freed you from attaching or clinging to things that were ultimately uncontrollable, represented true freedom. Sometimes I sum up that as, if you ain't got nothing, you got nothing to lose. And that's the definition of freedom. This morning, I want to turn to Martin Haglund's book, This Life, and take a look at what he has to say about the notion of freedom and how it either challenges or dovetails with some of the ideas we have of it from Buddhism and Buddhist practice. Now, he starts from a place that sounds very congruent with Buddhism. He says that the fundamental attributes of this life, or our mortality, which you can call our finitude, and our interdependence, this very much sounds like a description of Buddha nature. But the first distinction he makes is that he says that traditionally religious faith has been defined by an attempt to become free from those things, to be free from finitude, to be freed from the vulnerability of interdependence. And then we do this in a religious practice or religious faith by putting our faith in an object like God that is neither finite or dependent. God is eternal, omnipotent, invulnerable. And he says the basic form of faith in a religious practice is the attempt at either union with that kind of being that doesn't have these mortal limitations, or holds out the hope of an afterlife in which we are freed from the limitations of the body and enter into something that is eternal and invulnerable ourselves in this next life. Whether that's a fair characteristic of a characterization of religious practice is something we can discuss. But his alternative is what he calls secular faith. And that is defined not by an attempt to escape finitude and interdependency, but precisely by a valuing of those things as the basis of meaning in our life. That we find value in things precisely because they are impermanent, precisely because they depend on our efforts to hold and maintain them. Now, Hagelin grounds some of this idea in the work of Hegel, which may not be good news to most of you that we're going to take a detour through Hegel. But I hope you had a chance to read something of that third section where he gives you a basic outline of the development of Hegel's thought and how it relates to this idea of secular faith. But basically, wants to start with the idea that the great formative events for Hegel were the Enlightenment and the French Revolution. And these shook the foundations of what people considered to be the order of the world. You'd say the Enlightenment is characterized by an emphasis on human reason and the natural sciences as a way to understand the order of the world in terms of natural laws that are accessible to human reason, as opposed to religious faith that gives you a God-given order to the world. And the French Revolution sort of vividly demonstrated that the social order was not an inevitable extension of the natural order. There used to be a kind of picture of the great chain of being where the order of the universe is reflected in the order of society and in the way that God is the sovereign over the world, the king is sovereign over the country, and the social structure is imagined to be as natural and fixed as the natural laws of the world. And what the French Revolution very vividly demonstrated to that generation at the end of the 18th century was that the social order was not in any way God-given, but was created by us. And if it was created by us, it could be overturned by us, and something could be put in its place. And then that we were the creator of the moral, religious, and political norms that we had once taken to be God-given and somehow absolute or eternal. Now, Hegel credited Kant with the idea that the things that bind us morally are not eternal or God-given, but we are only bound by what we ourselves choose to be bound by, what we make a commitment to ourselves, that we have the responsibility to institute the norms that we follow. Now, Kant, to oversimplify considerably, tended to see this as an individual choice. I am bound to what I determine is binding. But he put in there the idea that because I'm a rational being, I will use reason to determine what binds me. And he thought that all rational beings should end up coming to the same conclusions about what should be binding. So in a certain way, he used reason to reinstitute a universalizable set of morality. Hegel's move was to take that process out of the individual and make it social and relational. He said, I don't individually ever decide what I ought to do or what's binding or what should be the object or meaning of my life. I belong to a society, a tradition, and I inherit a set of values and norms, which I am born into and begin by seeing as the background of what I see as moral or binding for myself. However, self-consciousness for Hegel meant that I recognize my own role, the role of others in constituting those norms, that I see that as something that's co-created. And for Hegel, this notion of things being co-created goes all the way down. His notion of how we understand or perceive the world, how we develop an idea of the self versus others, our sense of moral commitment, all of these things are co-created, the result of what we would now call intersubjectivity. And someone offered a very pithy 6-word summary of all of Hegel, and that is, you can't be yourself by yourself. Right? That at every level, who you are is constituted by your embeddedness in society and in the world. Contemporary developmental and psychoanalytic versions of that say that an infant's earliest sense of self is developed through interaction and impact on the mother, so that the child's sense of I comes from, I am the one who makes mommy smile. Mommy is the one that makes me smile. That these things arise together and through interaction. There's not a primordial inner sense of self that then has to go out and discover the world. Rather, the self comes into existence through interaction with the world. See, and this becomes a very important notion in terms of our practice, where we, in this model, the self is not interior, right? Our understanding of who we are doesn't arrive through an act of deep introspection, where we try to access something that's private or deep inside and known only to me, because I'm the only one who has access to my innermost experience, right? That's a very common sense kind of picture of the self as the true inner me. What we have emerging in Hegel, the idea of intersubjectivity, is that the true self is really outside, not inside. The true self is manifested in what I'm doing. It's manifest as a whole intersection of my relations and activities and my commitments. If you want to see who I am, watch what I do. Now, this has all sorts of reverberations for what does it mean to look for your true self or your original face or various other versions of that that arise in koans. Where are you going to find the true self? How can you show that to me? One way of talking about the self like this is to see it as performative or expressivist. I am what I do. Who I am emerges in the doing. There's not an inner me that comes out and expresses itself through the action so much as by performing the action, I become who and what I am. And I think we can see a version of this in Dogen, when Dogen talks about the identity of practice and realization. See, Dogen is adamant that Zazen is not a technique. It's not a means to an end. It's not something we do in order to have an enlightenment or to become enlightened. See, it goes against the grain of our very typical means to end thinking, where we engage in an activity to have this result that's external to the activity itself. Instead, what you have in Dogen, and what I think you have in various ways in Hegel, is this idea that the activity itself embodies its outcome, its meaning. So that when we sit Zazen, we're performing Buddhahood, we're performing enlightenment. In a certain sense, you know, the way the traditional Buddhist home-leaving model was says, if you live this life of no attachment, you're embodying impermanence and interdependency. There is also this kind of performative notion. You're not achieving something by doing that so much as the doing of it is the achievement. But in Dogen, he brings it back to be centered on Zazen itself. Although, in fact, he really means zazen in the context of a whole monastic life, a ritualized daily life, the performance of which is its own meaning, not a means to an end, but the end manifest in the doing. So one of the things that Hagland is going to take from Hegel is this idea that who we are is what we do and what we commit ourselves to. And the meaning of our life is our commitment to those practices and institutions that we value precisely because they are our own creation and our own commitments. They're not plugging us into anything that's a higher eternal world that somehow gives us a get out of jail card free, a get out of mortality card free, but that allows us to embrace and engage with the very things that we thought we were trying to avoid. Secular faith is not the avoidance of mortality and interdependency, but the embracing of those things. And he talks about various strategies that get smuggled into philosophy or religious practice. They covertly try to maintain that avoidance of our finitude. They're things that I would call curative fantasies, but primarily they're strategies of they pursue autonomy and pursue invulnerability. And Hegel outlines a number of these kinds of essentially defensive strategies that in one way or another, we have to move through and go beyond. In Hegel, that whole process is called the dialectic, in which we inevitably make our attempt at these kinds of avoidances, and it's only through their failure and overcoming them that we can move on to an alternative. One kind of avoidance was exemplified in what he called the master-slave relationship. And there the master attempts to be the person in total control, the person who has no vulnerability because all the vulnerability is in the servant or the slave. The servant is subject to the control and power of the master. And the master can imagine himself as having evacuated himself of all that vulnerability. We see many versions of this playing out psychologically in the creation of a despised other, where we try to shore up our own sense of autonomy or invulnerability by contrasting ourselves with an abject other of another race, very typically another gender. If you look at de Beauvoir or Jessica Benjamin's work, you see so much of how gender roles and the very ideas of masculine and feminine are created by this social splitting off of vulnerability and projecting it into the other. And Hegel's other kinds of examples that he critiques involve stoicism or skepticism, which in various ways involve a kind of pursuit of autonomy, trying to create an internal, invulnerable self by not holding on to any commitments or holding on to any beliefs. Each of these, in his mind, is ultimately doomed to failure. But in a way, it's only by attempting these things and failing at them do we come to see the inevitability and necessity of going beyond them into a kind of practice that actually embraces mortality and vulnerability instead of being preoccupied with strategies to overcome them. It may be that that's enough for this talk. I would say that some of this, we might say, could be summed up if we're thinking about the notion of freedom as we find it in our practice, is that we start saying that, you know, as Siddhartha said, you know, when he first left the security of his father's kingdom, you know, he said, sickness, old age, and death are ultimately unacceptable. I must find a way to be free of them. Right? And he engages in this intense pursuit of an enlightenment which will free him from these things. But what, in the end, does that freedom consist of? What Hagelin suggests, what Hegel is suggesting, is that our practice ultimately frees us from a fantasy of freedom. It frees us from the fantasy of somehow overcoming mortality, finitude, interdependence and vulnerability. It frees us from the fantasy of there being some other life or some other place or some other state that we can attain. It frees us to see that this moment, this life, is the only one there is.